Anne Le Havas, Alone in Tokyo, which is probably quite tricky, I would think. It was called The Greatest City in the World by the wonderful late great chef Anthony Bourdain, and he'd been around a few cities in the world. We talk about it now in a book called Tokyo Junkie, an account by a very accomplished journalist who's witnessed it all firsthand and in the process had his own dramatic personal transformation. And that person who's in Japan right now is Robert Whiting. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Should I be saying konnichiwa? Is that not strictly correct?
Yes, you can. Konnichiwa. Oh, genki desu ka? How are you?
Well, I looked it up, and there are 19 different ways at least to say hello in Japanese, which confused me a little.
Yes, there are. I won't go through them right now. I'm not sure I can remember them all. But konnichiwa will do. That's what most people say. Yes, that means good afternoon.
Oh, fair
enough.
In the
morning, you say ohayou gozaimasu. In the evening, konbanwa.
Very good, very good. Lessons in Japanese to boot. Nice to talk to you, Robert. So are you actually in Tokyo right now as we speak?
Yes, I am. I'm in Tokyo. It's 5:30 in the afternoon. I'm looking out the window at the sun setting over Tokyo Bay.
Wow, how fantastic.
Over Tokyo Bay.
Let's talk about your early days in Tokyo. What was it that first took you to that great city? I guess it wasn't a great city then. It was more of a kind of backwater, but what took you there in the first place?
Well, I was flunking out of college. I really was looking for something, and I joined the Air Force, and they sent me to Tokyo, which I didn't know anything about. The only thing about Japan I knew at the time, in 1962, was from the Godzilla movies that they showed at the local theater. But I got there, and I was just stunned by it. It was like the world's greatest construction site.
Wow.
They had, Tokyo had gotten the bid for the Olympics, and people were wondering how they were going to make it on time because they had no basic infrastructure.
Yeah.
I mean, no modern road system, no buildings over 10 stories, only one five-star hotel, the Imperial, that was falling apart.
Yeah.
You couldn't drink the tap water. There were rats everywhere. The infant mortality rate was very low. It was very high, excuse me. The average age of the Japanese was only 62 at the
time. Wow!
And so in this span, I got there, they were, in the middle of construction, and my first trip to Tokyo, I was just stunned by it. You stand and look on the street, and on one side they'd be tearing down buildings, on the other side they'd be putting them up. And in the span of 5 years, they put up 10,000 buildings.
Amazing.
8 overhead expressways, 2 subway lines, 5 five-star hotels, a monorail from Haneda Airport into the city, and a bullet train between Tokyo and Osaka.
How incredible.
Fastest train in the world.
And this, of course, was for the historic 1964 Olympics. Tokyo was the first city in Asia chosen to host the Games. Quite fortuitous we talk about it today because, of course, we're not far off the Japan Olympics. 78 days, in fact, till the next Japan Olympics.
That's right.
Yeah. Well,
fingers crossed.
Absolutely.
We're in the middle of the fourth COVID wave right now. And they insist they're going to hold them, and they're not requiring the athletes to be vaccinated, but they are going to keep them in a bubble, and they're going to be tested every day, and they won't be able to gather in groups, no cheering, everyone will be masked. And as soon as you finish your event, you've got to get on the plane and leave the country. Lots of luck with that. I know what, 20-year-old Olympic athletes are like, and you can't keep them in a bubble.
Absolutely. When you arrived back then in the early 60s, was there any anti-Americanism from the war years, or had that largely dissipated?
Well, there was some anti-Americanism in 1960 when they extended the security treaty and they kept American bases in Japan. There were, you know, huge demonstrations against it. But when, you know, JFK was elected president, you know, all of a sudden Americans were very popular. They really liked him, and they liked Jackie Kennedy.
Right.
And his brother Bobby Kennedy came on a tour of Tokyo, gave a speech at Waseda University. He was hugely popular. So all through the Olympics, it wasn't until the Vietnam War that the popularity of Americans started to go down.
Right.
And that was followed by the trade dispute, which made it even worse. But
Interesting. You went on to become an English tutor and an editor for Encyclopedia Britannica, which was one of the fastest growing companies in Japan. I believe you're warned by your more experienced American colleagues that Japan was not a place for a young man. Why did they say that?
Well, you know, Americans are very, you know, egocentric. You know, I forget the term that you use when you're talking about a country, but you know, they just couldn't imagine that anybody would, you know, want to stay, you know, in Japan over the United States. But you know, my feeling was that this Tokyo was under, you know, my attraction was the city, not the country. And
yeah.
The city was undergoing the greatest urban transformation in history. And in the span of 5 years, I told you what happened.
Yeah.
And in 1966, it was such a remarkable new high-tech megalopolis that they had produced that the James Bond crew went there with Sean Connery and filmed the movie You Only Live Twice.
Absolutely, yeah.
The energy of the place just sucked you in. I mean, there were more bars and restaurants and nightclubs per square kilometer in Tokyo than any other place in the world.
Amazing.
It was just magnetic. I mean, I just, you know, couldn't imagine not, you know, anybody not wanting to stay, actually.
Yeah, well, I was very lucky. I'm a record producer in another life, and I just produced a record for a girl which had gone to number one in Japan, and we went and toured, and we did six nights in Tokyo, and this is late 80s, I guess, 87, 88.
Yeah.
I was just, as we all were, gobsmacked by the city. It was just like, it was like walking on the set of Blade Runner, you know, at night in Tokyo.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. It just is a total knockout. That was the time, that was what they called the bubble era in Japan, and the Japanese had half the cash in the world.
Wow.
The top 10 banks were all Japanese. That was because of the Plaza Accord, when Japanese cameras, automobiles, TV sets were, you know, flooding the world.
Amazing.
And to stop these exports, the G6 got together and devalued the yen. They doubled the value of the yen overnight. It went from 100 240 yen to the U.S. dollar to 120. And they just were rolling in money. So that's when they started buying up Rockefeller Center and Columbia Studios and Pebble Beach Golf Course, California.
Amazing. My undying memory of it, and I'm delighted that it was being paid for by Virgin Records and not me, was how eye-wateringly expensive everything was. You know, just like a glass of orange juice was a mortgage.
Oh, yes. In fact, the real estate was so expensive that the Imperial Palace was worth more than the entire state of California. And if you wanted to buy an apartment, it was so expensive you had to take out a 100-year multi-generation loan to do it. That means your grandchildren would still be paying off the loan.
Goodness me. Goodness me.
But
incredibly, incredibly clean, though, incredibly orderly, incredibly efficient, incredibly polite. I mean, I remember my first trip on the bullet train. It arrived on time, it left on time, and it was extraordinary experience, all the rest of it. A very together place, as they are as people. But very regimented. I felt it was incredibly regimented. And back then, I was touring with a girl singer who had a woman manager as well. And there were some very odd conversations between us and the Japanese concert promoters, because they would regard the girl singer and the woman manager as kind of beneath them to talk to, which was quite a weird experience.
Well, it's a very hierarchical society. It's very, you know, it's difficult to. I'm probably the worst job in the world is to be a salaryman, an office worker in a Japanese company, you know, because you're working, you know, 12-hour days and weekends. You got to go golfing with the boss, and it's pretty hard. But you know, if you're in the if you're a writer like me and you have you control your own hours, it's quite enjoyable.
Absolutely. And I had my first experience there of a multi-story golf driving range in central Tokyo. And I, of course, made the mistake of not realizing that being on the top floor of the driving range, it would have been a really useful idea to put the bucket under the golf ball machine, and they poured out the balls and it fell about five stories down, and to much to the laughter of the four stories underneath me. But an incredible place. I recall particularly an area called Shinjuku, which at night was just extraordinary to walk around.
Oh, man, you could get Kabuki. You know, the center of Shinjuku is called Kabukicho, which has the highest density of bars and nightclubs in the world.
Wow.
And you can get anything that you want there. I have a picture of a bar in Kabukicho where the girls dress like nurses.
Yes.
And there's a doctor with a stethoscope standing outside. So you can go in and order a beer, and they'll take your blood pressure as you're drinking your beer.
And you mentioned these Tokyo salaryman, you know, the guys who are working endless hours, you know, and having endless meetings. And I found it really odd going into these bars, particularly in Shinjuku, that they would all kind of traipse into these bars with their working suits on, and they would just kind of sit there politely in a kind of really odd fashion, very kind of very weird, almost like in a trance after the day's work.
Well, they were probably there with the department head, so they couldn't really unwind. But, you know, when I was working for Britannica, you know, once the boss left, then they'd really unwind. They'd start drinking and start singing and, you know, showering insults at the guy at the next table. But because it's such a high pressure, I mean, you sit there like a robot all day for...
Yeah.
For 10 hours, and it's not like an American company anyway. You can throw spitballs at the next guy and, lighten up the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And you have to, there's all sorts of etiquette about who gets on the elevator first. You know, if your boss is standing there, he's got to go first. It's everybody has a name card with their position on it, so there's this very hierarchical structure. Mm-hmm. You have to have meetings every day, even if there's nothing to discuss, because this is what keeps the glue, corporate harmony together.
Wow. Well, I hope the boss of our radio station isn't listening to that. Meetings every day, I think, would probably finish most of us off. Let's talk about the kind of the dark side of Tokyo, because there very much is a dark underbelly. We have the ones that maybe, I guess, the kind of mafia, the Yakuza that people know about, but there is a dark underbelly in Tokyo, and you kind of learned about that and came face-to-face with it, didn't you, while you were there on and off?
Yes, it was when I was working for Britannica in Shinjuku. I lived nearby, just a couple train stops away, and there was a snack across the street, a snack bar where I used to go and make bets on baseball, you know, small-time stuff.
Mm.
And I got to know this one gangster who was running the betting pool. And he looked at me one night, and he said, Bob... I'm from Okinawa, and Japanese don't like Okinawans, and you're from America, and Japanese don't like Americans.
Right.
So let's be friends.
Wow.
So he took me around and introduced me to his boss, and I had graduated from the University of Sophia, just Jesuit school in Japan, with a degree in political science, and I had met the political leaders, and I'd written a thesis about the ruling Liberal Democratic Party. So his boss thought that was really great. He said, oh, we support the ruling Liberal Democratic Party. You know, we help get out the vote. We raise money for them. And in return, they give us, you know, construction jobs. Wow. And so, you know, the organized crime controlled all the construction in Japan at the time, which was hugely, you know, like 20% of the GDP was construction, public works in Japan.
Amazing.
But they would control everything, the lodging for the workers, the security on the site, after hours gambling, the brothels, the boxed lunches. It was just an enormous money-making enterprise for the Yakuza.
Amazing. And to immerse yourself in the culture of somewhere for that long, I guess you had to immerse yourself in the Japanese language. For those who were there for just a brief time, I thought I'd be clever and try and, read a bit of it and write a bit of it. I bought a book, as we all do, but goodness me. I don't know how you did, Robert, but I found it absolutely unlearnable.
Well, you have to pick a subject that you're interested in. Like, I really like to watch sumo and American baseball, which is enormously popular in Japan. And they have sports daily newspapers in Japan, which, circulations of over a million each. Very colorful, colorful big headlines. And I was curious about what went on. And so that's where I learned. I took my dictionary to the coffee shop and bought a newspaper. Because of that subject, I learned how to read. Because I'm interested, if it had been economics or something else, then I don't think I would ever mastered the language.
Right. And then let's talk about, you alluded to it at the start there, COVID and Japan. As outside observers of Asia, we are kind of under the impression that places like Thailand and Cambodia and Vietnam and Japan were kind of pretty good at dealing with it all. Is that the case in Japan or not then?
Well, it was. I mean, Japanese people are very clean. The country's very hygienic. People don't shake hands, they bow, there's no kissing or hugging.
Yeah.
You take off your shoes before you go in the house. If you go into the bathroom, you have to put on another pair of slippers.
Yeah.
And so they're very clean, and they're, they listen to authority when the government says, don't do this and don't do that. They'll basically do it. You don't have to pass a law.
Yeah.
And but the problem was that they had these, sort of voluntary shutdowns that hurt the economy. So the Japanese government tried to inject some energy by offering discounts. They would pay, if you wanted to take a trip somewhere, the government said they would pay half of it. If you wanted to go out to a nice restaurant, the government said they would pay half the bill. They get the economy going again.
Right.
And that's what caused a huge spike in COVID, which people are trying to get over now.
Uh-huh.
And of course, this new variant from India is coming in, and they just started a vaccination program here. I get my shot at the end of this month, my first shot, and three weeks after that I get my second, but they're way behind the rest of the world.
Amazing. And so if you were to, right now, I mean, Europe are kind of opening up, how difficult is it to get into Japan now as an outsider? Almost impossible, I would guess, then.
Not now, you can't. No, if you get, I think in a couple months by Olympic time, it'll be much easier. As long if you have a shot, if you have your shots and you have a PCR test before, 3 days before you fly in, I think they'll let you to come in.
And have they got the same thing, for example, as Thailand would have, that you'd have to spend 2 weeks in a government hotel quarantining?
Yes, that was the rule all for the past year. But I think that will be relaxed by July.
Yeah, interesting, interesting.
Bach, the head of the IOC, is coming over on the 15th. I don't think they're going to put him in quarantine.
No, absolutely. And so after all these years of the kind of bright lights in the back alleys of Tokyo, if you had your time to do over again, would you choose a different city than Tokyo to spend your life in?
Well, I lived in New York for several years.
Yeah.
So I quite liked it at the time. And my wife worked for the UN for 25 years. And so she was stationed all over the place. She lived in Paris, Geneva, Stockholm, Karachi, Dhaka, Mogadishu, Nairobi. And I think right now I would pick Tokyo because it's in its golden era. It's in number one in so many different areas. It's got the more Michelin-starred restaurants. restaurants in any other country in the world. It's got three times as many three-star Michelin restaurants as Paris. Mm. It's got the highest GDP. It's the richest city in the world. It's the largest city in the world. It's the safest. It's got the most, the cleanest, most efficient, most extensive subway and train system in the world.
Yeah.
So right now, it's at its peak. I don't know how long it's going to last. There's a huge national debt and an aging society. But right now, Tokyo's number one. In fact, Global Finance did a survey last November and ranked Tokyo as the most livable city in the world.
Amazing.
By any number of metrics, yeah.
Well, it's a fascinating place, and your book tells the story beautifully. Tokyo Junkie, 60 Years of Bright Lights and Back Alleys and Baseball by Robert Whiting. Been a pleasure to talk to you, Robert. Domo arigato, I think, is correct. Is that correct?
Thank you. Arigato gozaimasu.
It's been lovely to talk to you. You look after yourself and take care. All the best, Robert. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.